transcend that. It's a very, very broad, stupid statement. It's like, you know, okay, Miss Universe, what do you want? I want peace and love. Well, yeah. And the one thing that I hope that we bring to people on these airwaves is perhaps a little understanding. Mm. The third part of the famous Peace, Love, and Understanding troika, I hope that both Earth Watch and Hour of the Wolf do that.
And ain't nothing funny about that. Jim Freund, my friend, my colleague, this radio station, you listening, WBAI, all of it comes together right now. I'm Robert Knight. This has been Earthwatch. Thank you for listening. Drop us a note, 120 Wall Street, New York, 1-555, or communicate to rknight, R-K-N-I-G-H-T, at WBAI.org. Also, tune in 5 p.m. Well, I guess it's at 5 o'clock shadow.
Don't shave.
I'm used to close shaves. Stay tuned for Hour of the Wolf with Jim Freund coming up. And a little bit of taste of some more Jim Webb. See you next week.
In your hands, and the old men playing checkers by the tree. MacArthur Park is melting in the dark, all the sweet green I see flowing down. Oh, someone left the cake out in the rain, and I don't think that I can take it, 'cause it took so long to bake it, and I'll never have that recipe again.
Flow like rivers through the sky.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf. As Robert said, last of the year, next year first of the decade. My name is Jim Freund. This morning, well, unlike any of the Hours of the Wolf in this time slot, they were all very planned. This one, not so much. Freeform. Stay tuned. Good morning. If I'm out of breath, it's because I ran to I've been here talking with Robert, and before that, talking with Ian Forrest, and having a grand old BAI time. Since Hour of the Wolf moved from the Hour of the Wolf, which is defined as that time between night and dawn, the time when most people are believed to die, and most children are born, a time when dreams are real. This is an ancient belief that very Scandinavian and Roman. In Scandinavia, it's called Vargtimen. Ingmar Bergman made a movie called Vargtimen in English, Hour of the Wolf. Margot Adler titled the radio show Hour of the Wolf from the Bergman film. She chose the theme music by Peter Schickele from the movie Silent Running that you just heard. And by the way, for reasons that I'm not necessarily going to go into the details of, let me ask everybody listening to send out healing thoughts, warm thoughts of healing and good spirit to Margot Adler. Particularly tonight through tomorrow morning. So, everything should be fine, but it will be no worse than if everybody is thinking good thoughts about Adler. Anyway, this show got moved, I guess, 7 weeks ago. Well, first it was basically canceled. Or simply taken out of its time slot, and then this time slot proposed, which with Robert Knight's grace allowing a half hour for me, because normally, of course, Earthwatch, should be a 2-hour show, would go to 2 a.m., right? But instead, 1:30 to 3, okay, so this is like my sixth or seventh week here. And what I have been doing in these slots up until now has been to, A, initiate the slot, like I did where the very first show was Rick Bowes, and I had Nora Jemison because she had a new book out. And in between that, I actually did a freeform thing, relatively, is I invited on this playwright who wrote the play and directed it to Android's Dream of Electric Sheep, and Matt Kressel, writer and editor and publisher Matt Kressel, also co-host of the KGB Fantastic Fiction Reading Series, who is a great lover of another version of Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep. That novel by Philip K. Dick was turned into a movie called Blade Runner. and Matt is a huge fan of Blade Runner. I respect and admire the movie on many levels, but I have a lot of issues with it. And then you have The Advocate for the Play, and I put it on then because I had the opportunity to do it, something that would not have happened in the earlier previous slot of 38 years, 5 to 7 a.m. But something that when Margot Adler started the program, Hour of the Wolf, 5 days a week, from 5 to 7 a.m., she did the first, 2.5 years. Then I took over the show, and I continued doing 5 days a week for about 2 years, and then I did 3 days a week, then 2 days a week, and then I was bumped unceremoniously, but very well, although I went kicking and screaming, to Saturday mornings, which turned out very well. Now I've been bumped, kicking and screaming, but, you know, for whatever reasons here. But this has, you know, as Robert said, the starting out with the speculations from science and politics into the speculations from fiction that relate to science and politics, I think is a very good one. And by the way, being followed by Lister is way cool. Yeah, I really miss following Hobte and Ian, and I really miss preceding Simon Locally. We were with Simon and I formed sort of a literary block. But what I have not been able to do in this time slot, aside from the fact that it's hard to have elbow room, you know, after a writer has read a story on the air, or I've played a recording or something like that, I have not had the room to just talk to you, the listeners. I've not had the chance to say, okay, let's see who's out there. When Margot, pardon, I'm leaning down as I'm plugging something into the computer here so I have all my musics and stuff available. When the very first day of Hour of the Wolf in January 1972, so I guess we're reaching an anniversary there, I guess to start our 39th year, when Adler started Hour of the Wolf, the very first thing she did was take phone calls. The very first thing she did was introduce herself, talk, do live radio, freeform radio in the classic manner, as Robert said. You know, I'm not putting anybody down when I say she is my favorite. I'm not saying who's the best. I'm saying what Adler did just amazed me. Absolutely glued me to the radio, or not necessarily the radio, because I was often enough her engineer, or at least her hanger-outer, or bunny, as we used to say in the old days. Bunny used to have a more explicit meaning, and then just became, well, you know, like an assistant secretary, and just, you know, all things to the person on the air. There were post bunnies, fast bunnies, and there may or may not have been a Gorman bunny, you know, somebody to help him. And I was the Adler bunny, in, you know, the strictly platonic sense of bunny, right? So anyway, we took calls. She took calls. This is how we initiated the show. I haven't had the luxury to do that. And yet, as we move into 2011, as things go, I will have, I have still at least one guest, John Sprunk, who was supposed to have been on my show in October, and I bounced him to October from an earlier month because we went into a thon when I wasn't expecting it. And then I rescheduled him at a time when my show was basically limboed. I won't say canceled. It was limboed. I ended up here, so it wasn't canceled. So I mean to have John Sprunk on, and he doesn't live in the city, so we have to figure out a time when he can take off from work and come here. We need to, next week, John Joseph Adams, and this is again a freeform kind of a thing. I wasn't planning to have him on, but he's leaving New York. I mean, I plan to have him on eventually. He's leaving New York. He's going to California. He is a publicist with Nightshade Books. He's editor of Lightspeed Magazine. He does co-does a podcast called The Geek's Guide to the Galaxy. And a very influential editor of anthologies. So, got to have him on. It's going to be like 3 days before he leaves the city. Another friend, a fine writer, is going to be leaving for Detroit from New York, Saladin Ahmed. No, you don't necessarily know his name unless you follow short stories in some of the better magazines. Saladin will, you know, by this time, oh, certainly, well, probably by this time next year, the first book of his trilogy will be out. And I've been calling it an arabesque trilogy, and he may well agree with that. So, in other words, and you know what? By the time I fulfill these needs, we'll be into the next Thon, which I believe will be much of the month of February. And after the next Thon, I wouldn't expect all of WBAI's programming to resemble what it does today, just as you know, it all changed in late October, early November. The station is changing. If it's not changing for the better, it's not going to be around. And, you know, I really like some of the changes. And there are other the changes that I consider complete head scratchers. And there are some changes that I don't care for. But I applaud the fact that there are changes, period. And I think a lot of them are good. To be blunt, I would rather be back in my cubbyhole on Saturday mornings from 5 to 7 a.m. But I'm pleased to be a part of the change. And by the way, it provides a challenge to me. You know, after I was Saturday mornings, 5 to 7 a.m. for, oh, like 18 years. So this is a new, cool thing and is obviously a decent situation. So I do have a book at hand, which, by the way, is another tradition from the earliest days of Hour of the Wolf, would be to choose a short story and read it on the air. And I have one in mind by William Gibson. And I may very well, it's a short story, it's a short, short story. And I may, called The Gernsback Continuum, and I may very well get around to reading that. But I also have, a couple of announcements to make, and I'd like to open the phones and talk to people. I may actually want to do that after the story, but I'm willing to give it just a little taste. If people want to call up and discuss Hour of the Wolf through the years, science fiction and fantasy, we are not here to discuss programming changes. We are not here to discuss fundraising drives. If you heard me last week, I yelled at a listener. Something I rarely do. I like to think of myself as a congenial host. The point is that if you're not on topic, you're off. And I determine the topic. And also, as Robert was talking a bit about technology earlier, I will entertain things on topic. And a couple of calls are coming in. Let me mention the numbers 212-209-2900. But I have an announcement to make, and I'm going to do that first. This coming Tuesday, January 4th, the reading series that I produce, it's not officially affiliated with the station, although much of what happens there gets broadcast on this program, the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, of which I am the curator, executive curator, and producer. We will have a guest curator. I bring in other people to be the curator so that they, in turn, invite people that I otherwise won't know or wouldn't be able to get. It broadens the horizon of the reading series. And I asked Ron Hogan, and Ron is, well, I am pleased with myself. He's a perfect choice, if I say so myself. This will be his first outing. His bio reads, Ron Hogan helped create the literary internet by launching Beatrice.com in 1995. His most recent book is Getting Right with Tao, I guess, T-A-O, I would say Tao, the Tao, a print edition of the popular online translation of the Tao Te Ching into modern vernacular. He's also author of The Stewardess Flying the Plane, a visual tribute to 70s Hollywood, and a contributor to the New York Times bestseller Not Quite What I Was Planning, and the critical anthology Secrets of the Lost Symbol. He reviews science fiction and fantasy novels for Shelf Awareness. Okay, so Ron is, you know, like, yes, he's got one foot in science fiction, but he's also this literary figure. So who does he book for our next reading? Rick Moody and Gary Steingart. Okay, that's like, oh my God. You know, we are, you know, let's just plucked out of the New York Times bestseller lists, right? Plucked out of the big mainstream, with fingers wiggling over that. These are writers, though, whose latest books are, well, without question, speculative fiction. They are reaching into that world of what if, worlds that are not real, cannot be real, but on the other hand, well, are speculative. This includes fantasy, science fiction, not as much horror, although that can certainly be in there, but it is the fantastic genre. And speculative fiction, as coined by Bob Heinlein, Robert A. Heinlein, in the late 40s, is an excellent, excellent term that has come nowadays to mean literary science fiction. And fine, so be it. Rick Moody is the author of the novels Garden State, which won the Pushcart Press Editor's Book Award, The Ice Storm, anybody see that movie with Kevin Kline? Purple America, and The Diviners, or Diviners, two collections of stories, The Ring of Brightest Angels Around Heaven, and Demonology. He's also written a memoir, The Black Veil. He is the winner of the Penn/Martha Albrand Award. He also received the Addison Metcalf Award, the Paris Review, AGA Prize Award, and a Guggenheim Fellowship. His latest novel is The Four Fingers of Death, in which a likable but ill-starred and unevenly gifted author named Montaise Crandall writes the novelization of a movie that came out in 2025. Let's not get too ahead of ourselves. It's only set 15 years in the future, not 515 years in the future. A 2025 remake of a B-movie horror flick. Okay, so you got that, right? This is, you know, a fellow whose writing gets made into big-budget films, independent, but nevertheless, you know, major films with major stars. His books are, you know, considered major literature, capital L, you know, by anybody who wants to be a snob about it. And his latest book is, you know, takes place 15 years in the future. Is that science fiction or what? Gary Steingart, our other reader, was born in Leningrad in 1972 and came to the U.S. 7 years later. His debut novel, The Russian Debutante's Handbook, won the Stephen Crane Award for First Fiction and the National Jewish Book Award for Fiction. His second novel, Absurdistan, I read that one, was named one of the 10 best books of the year by the New York Times Book Review, as well as best book of the year by Time Magazine, The Washington Post Book World, The San Francisco Chronicle, The Chicago Tribune, and many other pubs. He has been selected as one of Granta's best young American novelists. His work has appeared in The New Yorker, Esquire, GQ, and Travel and Leisure, and his books have been translated into more than 20 languages. His new novel, Super Sad True Love Story, which is, by the way, I saw Margot Adler reading that very same book about 3 or 4 weeks ago, and it's the only book of the last 125 books that she has read that isn't a vampire book. That's another story. Super Sad True Love Story was described in the New York Times Review as a wonderful novel that gives us a cutting comic portrayal of a futuristic America nearly ungovernable and perched on the abyss of fiscal collapse. And at the same time, it is a novel that chronicles a sweetly real love affair as it blossoms from its awkward, improbable beginnings. Okay, have we struck gold for this reading? Are you going to come? Well, the admission is free. Okay, I'll start with that. You will find us asking for donations on the way in, because otherwise, when dinner needs to be bought for our curator and two writers, I gotta pay it. And while that's an honor, I can't afford it, okay? So we're asking for a donation on the way in, but please, I don't care if you give nothing. I want you to come, okay? Admission is free. That's this coming Tuesday, January 4th. Doors open at 6:30 p.m. The address, I didn't put it at the top of my own press release, huh? That's really bleeping stupid. 138 Sullivan Street. 138 Sullivan Street. It's the Soho Gallery for Digital Art, which, by the way, is just a fabulous venue. We have, oh my God, I have a week in which to put that artwork together. I have to remind Ron. We have Gary Steingart's artwork. We don't have Rick Moody's yet. Okay, so 138 Sullivan Street, that's between Houston and Prince, 6:30 to rub elbows, 7 o'clock for the reading. I am hoping that we're going to be very crowded. We seat about 50 people, and we may very well get more than that. So please, please show up. And I'll repeat that information, in just about an hour at the very end of the show. Okay. For more information, go to my website, ourwolf.com, ourwolf.com, or look me up on Facebook, Jim Freund on Facebook, and I have a link. There's actually an events page for that event. Okay, if you have been patient, if you'd like to call and discuss science fiction, fantasy, Hour of the Wolf, who are you at this hour, and all that, again, we are not here to discuss station politics, pro or con, even politics of the world, pro or con. I don't do that well. I really, really don't. And, you know, that's all there is to it. The number is 212-209-2900. And good morning, you're on the radio. Hello.
A moment.
Yeah, we're on delay, so people have to turn down their radios. How are you doing?
Been worse, thank you. Yourself?
Likewise. Although I've been having a wonderful week. My partner is off from work, and she and I have been sitting around. She's been writing. I've been trying to be creative.
Like a pig in stuff, as the saying goes.
Indeed.
Otherwise would bleep.
Otherwise would bleep. So how are you? I haven't seen you in a long time.
Yep, just pretty much don't get out much.
Well, you ought to, or at least we ought to get together. I should explain to listeners, this is a friend of mine going back, 35 years? More?
1970.
That more. There we 35. Go. Okay, very good, Gary. Okay.
I do that arithmetic in my head. I spent 2 years in college, you know.
Oh, well, I dropped out of high school, you know.
Yeah, I know, but you're smart.
That doesn't make up for not knowing math.
Here's the thing. The stuff about praying for Margot?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, sending out signals.
Good. What's her mother's name?
Oi.
Well, indeed. What's her mother's name?
I don't recall. Her father was Kurt Adler. Her grandfather is Alfred Adler, as in Freud, Adler, and Jung.
Yep.
I don't remember Margot's mother's name.
I'm asking because it's a traditional kind of thing.
Okay. Let me see. I wouldn't be surprised if it's on Wikipedia. I'm serious.
I understand.
I'm serious. I found out on Facebook that her middle name, Susanna, was for a character out of a Mozart opera, which I never knew.
Which one?
Susanna is in... which opera is... Marriage of Figaro.
Oh, I am so dumb, and you are so smart.
Uh-huh, indeed. Yeah, well, I just happen to like Mozart.
Well...
And Wagner, and Gilbert and Sullivan.
You're passively smart, at least as far as Mozart and Gilbert and Sullivan are concerned.
I guess so. I clicked on the wrong thing.
You're doing it even as we speak?
Yeah, that's why I'm off mic.
You child of the 80s.
Well, I mean, computing is something I've been doing since, yes, the early 80s. You know, it's, ever since I got my Atari computer in about 1981. And, of course, I write about, what I try to do for a living when I can is I am a writer and editor about technology.
Yeah. Doesn't pay much these days, though.
No, well, you know, it pays okay. The problem is you can't get the work. It's very, very difficult to find anybody who has a freelance budget. You know, it's amazing. If you go to Wikipedia and you just type in Margot, she's actually the fourth person down there. You don't have to type more than Margot, and Wikipedia says the fourth best guest is Margot Adler. So, let's see. Little Rock, Arkansas, education, journalism and radio, neo-paganism.
Little Rock, Arkansas?
Yep, that's where she was born. That I know.
Margot Adler?
Margot Adler, our Margot.
A Jewish girl from the Bronx born in Little Rock?
Bronx. Manhattan.
Okay.
Never lived in the Bronx.
Even worse. Why Little Rock?
She, there's a song about that. I'm not sure. I guess, you know, her parents were just there for a while. But, you know, that apartment... She has a great apartment, which we won't disclose the location of, has been in her family since Alfred Adler.
Hmm.
The Adler, well, then that would be disclosing the location. But, you know.
Don't do it then.
No, I won't. But, you know, it's, well, the building is sort of named after her family.
Stop.
No, well, you see, no, that was a purposefully obscure clue.
Yeah, but a clue is a clue.
Indeed. No, I'm afraid Wikipedia doesn't have the name of her mother.
Somebody's got to.
Well, I'm sure she does. I'm not going to call her now.
No, why? It's almost 2 a.m.
Yeah, well, actually, I suspect she's awake. But
well, let's leave her.
Yeah, I think so.
So, Tuesday on Sullivan Street at 6:30, you say?
Yes. Any chance you'll be there?
I don't prognosticate. But why jinx anything?
Yeah. Well, you know, if you don't make it there, send me an email at home, not Facebook. Not Facebook. I don't do email on Facebook. I'm jim@ourwolf.com.
Fair enough. I don't do Facebook either because it always freezes my computer.
Yeah. Well, I could go on about Facebook. But, yeah, no, your brother does Facebook, God knows.
Oh, ow.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, I need those pictures of me as a 3-year-old.
I may have some. I certainly have some of John Singer and other friends of ours.
Oh, please.
Yeah. We're talking, by the way, this is the culture that is the culture of science fiction fandom. And when I started Hour of the Wolf, I really didn't realize that there were radio listeners out there who weren't members of fandom. So I might very well have, you know, come back from a science fiction convention or something like that and done what all fans talk about when they go to a science fiction convention, talk about which place had the best Mandarin dumplings in that city.
Yep.
This is what science fiction fans do. And Hour of the Wolf was a great showcase for it. After a few years, I began to realize other people were listening. After a few years after that, I realized that there are more people listening at this minute right now than all the people that attend science fiction conventions in this country do in an entire year accumulated together. And at that point, I realized maybe I should talk to other people as well.
a little less cloistered.
Yes, just a bit.
Maybe we have a science fiction show and we should talk about science fiction because the people who don't really care about the Mandarin dumplings in San Francisco or Detroit or...
Yeah, Toronto was more like it, you know. I remember John Singer going on about that in a zine which included you, as a matter of fact.
Oh, dull, I presume.
No, actually, it was a lot of fun. It was TAPS. It was an APA. You see, before... There were BBSs, before there were conversation threads on CompuServe, before people talk to each other, you can't even thread on Facebook or a community website. For decades before, there were amateur press associations that were done on mimeograph machines, and that was very much came out of the culture, the subculture of science fiction fandom. And so that's what an APA is. And we all have our own languages. And yes, by the way, we invented smileys. So there.
And a lot more.
Oh, yes, a lot more.
I you remember the Eric Raymond book, the bestseller, A about, I think, a lexicon of internet terms?
Yes, I do, as a matter of fact.
So
Eric S. Raymond, one of the people who brought Linux forth onto the world.
So much of that was science fiction fan slang from the 40s and 50s.
Yeah.
And updated.
Yeah, very much so. And he was certainly a member of the fanzine community.
Yeah. I lent him $20 to get home from a science fiction convention once.
Has he paid you back?
Oh, yeah. Hank Davis made him.
Okay, then, yeah, good, because he had a start an internet startup that made tens of millions of dollars. So
yeah,
he should pay
before then.
Yeah, oh, okay, well.
When he walked around in a robe.
Still does. No, that's unfair. That's unfair.
Okay, let me get off the rodeo.
Okay, thanks so much. Good to hear your voice.
You too.
Take care.
Good luck on Tuesday. Everybody show up.
Yes, please. Take care.
See you later.
Bye-bye. Oh, I should mention, by the way, Tuesday, yes, Gary Steingart and Rick Moody. February, not bad, Samuel R. Delaney and Andrea Hairston, but we're slumming, okay? And good morning, you're on the radio. Whoop, no, you're a dial tone, so you won't be on the radio long. Hi there, you're on the air. Good morning.
Hello. Yes, hello, Jim?
Yes, you're on the air.
Hi, yes, I really have one brief question. I've been listening to you since the fall of 78, and I remember that because that was the month the Ralph Bakshi's Lord of the Rings came out, and you did a whole show reviewing it.
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps my memory is fallible, but wasn't the show for a time, didn't it have the title Against the Fall of Night?
Yes.
That was
a different show. That was a midnight to 5 a.m. show.
Ah, then that's probably where I heard the Tolkien, the review of the movie. That's probably the venue at which I heard it.
That might well be. There was a time when a lot of WBAI people did more than one show. And this is something that currently I'm sad. When I said there were things that have occurred, I said I wasn't going to talk about programming changes. There are people that do more than one show that should be allowed to do more than one show. And not just Robert Knight with Earthwatch and 5 o'clock Shadow, but Max Schmid. The golden age of radio is sort of like the service he provides. But, Mass Backwards is his playground.
Oh, that's right. I recall now you have two different, completely different areas covered.
Yeah, exactly.
What was the thing, if I can ask you, was there a difference in content between Hour of the Wolf and Against the Fall of Night? What was the impetus for creating the new show, other than that was just more airtime?
Anyway, I think it was just more airtime. Each one of these slots is very different. I would say that the show I'm doing at this minute bears little or no relationship to Hour of the Wolf 5 to 7 a.m. But after, 38 years of that time slot, of that show existing, wherever I go, even if it was 12 noon, I would keep the name because it's branded and I'm branded with it.
Well, I really love it when you read the short stories. The first one I heard you do, I think, was by Robert Sheckley.
Ah, well, that's always a favorite. And I am promising, by the way, that before 2011 is out, I am going to have a major Sheckley event. But I haven't confirmed it yet. I have spoken with Sheckley's daughter about such a thing. But that was like a year and a half ago, and I have to talk to her again to do like this whole tribute. I can promise that in May, I'm going to be doing a whole big Sturgeon event with Theodore Sturgeon's family.
This is the last thing I'll say, and then I'll get off the line. Is if I can make a request. I've always been curious on all the when you've done analyses of some of the classic authors. I don't believe I've ever heard you talk about H.P. Lovecraft or Robert E. Howard or the sort of nexus between the two. And I realize you've got probably 800 ideas for shows coming up, but if I could just put that bug in your ear.
It's not impossible. I have tapes of the very earliest Hours of the Wolf, if that would be the plural, it would be Hour of the Wolves. not even wolves, but wolves. I did a lot of Eldritch stuff. The main reason being that there was this fabulous radio professional by the name of Willis Conover, who was professionally a Voice of America, and I suspect, therefore, you know, today would be more politically in the camp of, shall we say, Palin-type people. But in terms of his knowledge of people, he brought me Lovecraft's wife, Sonia Green. You know, I was able to interview Frank Belknap Long. A regular who Margot brought on the air was Hans Stefan Santesen, who was certainly a member of the Lovecraft circle. And so I didn't do as many shows of Lovecraft as having people that were there. And a part of it. And then Baird Searles, who, of course, was the drama and literature director of WBAI in the fabulous 60s, did a lot of Lovecraft productions. I would not consider myself an expert on it. Oh, I did a couple of shows with L. Sprague de Camp and Lynn Carter.
Oh, God. Two of my favorites, yeah.
Yeah, and I would love to I have to digitize my archives. But first I have to locate them. I have shopping bags full of unlabeled tapes, and they need digitizing, which is a big job.
Listen, good luck in that. Thanks for all the years that you've been on. It was always, I've never regretted staying up late or getting up early to listen to you, and looking forward to many more into the coming year, Jim.
I hope so. Thanks.
Take care.
Take care. Bye-bye. Yeah. Oh, and by the way, let me just extol and just, you know, go more into the ego boo that is already myself. It's my birthday, so I'm, you know, that's one of the reasons I'm doing such a completely self-indulgent show. Good morning. You're on the air. Hi, turn down your radio, please.
Okay.
Good morning. There you go.
Yeah.
How are you?
Hi, yeah. Enjoying the broadcast. You know, you... That fellow, Max Need, he played Raymond Chandler. He played Ray Bradbury. Those were great. Yeah, I really loved hearing Ray Bradbury. And I thought Raymond Chandler was somehow very relevant, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he played my Bradbury interview on his big roundup of stuff for Bradbury's 90th birthday.
Yes, which that was great. That was great, because I've loved Bradbury for you. Since I was a child.
Yeah, same here. I mean, he was one of the first for me, one of the first people I read. My parents gave me his books, S is for Space and R is for Rocket, not quite realizing that these weren't primers.
That's funny.
And those are not books for kids. I mean, it's not that they've, you know, they're not ribald or anything like that, but they were sophisticated.
Well, you know, that kiddie stuff is ridiculous because a lot of kids don't need that. They can deal with things straight on.
I believe so.
Yeah, I mean, too, especially, you know.
We may not, you know, when we were kids, we may not have understood it all, but it gave us something to reach for.
Right, and it's a good rung to come up on, too. It's not a false rung, yeah. Yeah. Well, you know what I'd like to hear you do right now is, David Hartwell intrigues me, and this is a guy who got a PhD from Columbia, went into, you know, well, I guess at the time was considered a pulp form of literature, you know, fantasy and science fiction,
mm-hmm.
and has been with it since it's been elevated to the point now where you got Rick Moody and that other guy.
And David Hartwell, I should point out, is the publisher of the magazine, the New York Review of Science Fiction, which started that whole reading series, which is that reading.
Oh.
You know, so we're not that far removed.
Oh, well, does he attend these, or does he just kind of has... Stepped away from it.
No, he stepped away from it a long, long time ago. Actually, the reading series was started by Gordon Van Gelder, who worked with Hartwell on the magazine in its earliest days, like 22 years ago. Gordon is now owner and editor of the magazine of fantasy and science fiction. And then they worked together when Hartwell was and still is at Tor Books. The other is at... Gordon was at St. Martin's Press. These are, you know, related companies are, in fact, two floors apart on the Flatiron Building.
Yeah.
So it's actually a very small, incestuous world.
Well, I think it's a great world because, you know, I
now that I'm in this new slot, I should try to get Hartwell back on. He was last on the show when he launched the magazine, the New York Review of Science Fiction.
How long ago was that, 22 years ago?
21.
Oh, my, that's too long, isn't it? I mean, for someone of his stature?
It is, but he lives way the heck out in Jersey. He has a long, long commute, and for him to come in at 5 a.m. is not easy.
Well, I'm sure you could tape him, give him a break, you know. And
yeah, but now, yeah, I think we could work something out. Oh, Gordon Van Gelder, by the way, the aforementioned, who is rarely on the radio or anything, will be on this show in February.
Oh, this is great. Yeah, this is cool. Because, you know, one thing about what you do is that there's so few real literary discussions about the contemporary, the market as it is today at all, you know. And so when you're talking about fantasy and science fiction, it's really up to date and it's really exciting to, you know, in the Nebula and Hugo Awards, that's really great stuff, and it's just such a shame that it doesn't happen in other parallel literary forms, literary, you know.
It happens to a lesser extent in mysteries.
Oh,
but a much, you know, I mean, we have the Mysterious Bookshop in New York, we had Partners in Crime, but it's not the same. And there are a few conventions, but there's like 50 or 60 major science fiction conventions a year, maybe three or four major mystery conventions a year. And I don't count the comic conventions, which are a whole other animal.
Comic books?
Like Comic-Con?
That's comic books?
Yeah, well, it started from comic books.
Oh.
But Comic-Con has become like the place where Hollywood premieres all of its announcements of movies and TV shows and stuff like that. You have more TV stars.
That are derived from comic books?
Yes.
Well, there's a lot of them, that's true.
Oh, well, absolutely. I mean, there's very little stuff out there that, at this point, in the major commercial marketplace, that didn't start from comics.
Well, look, when you do comics and mysteries and science fiction and fantasy are way ahead on a literary level in those two forms. So, you know.
It's very true, but I love it when the so-called great mainstream writers like Moody and Steingart and people like Michael Chabon are now embracing science fiction.
Well, I mean,
that's very different from when the show started, when science fiction was still that, you know, it was Star Trek stuff, and then it became that Star Wars stuff.
Well, before Star Wars or Star Trek.
Well, before that, it was that Buck Rogers stuff.
It was pulp fiction, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it was always, you know, the ghetto of literature.
Right, that teenagers loved, yes.
Yeah, exactly, yeah, exactly.
Right. Wow. Well, this is good. I'll look forward to that reading. I'm sure you're going to get a great, great crowd.
I hope so.
Oh, please. You know, I mean, how could you not? But I think that Rick Moody and others, you know, they're going where the action is, you know, where the energy is. So
yeah, I mean, you never know. You never know. We've had readings with major figures in literature. Jonathan Lethem pulled in under 30 people.
Is that good or bad?
That's bad.
Oh,
that's bad. When we had Susanna Clark, now Susanna was a phenom when she read for us when her novel Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell came
novel.
Out.
Great novel.
A wonderful novel. We had well over 100 people.
Well, that was good, right?
That's wonderful.
But Lethem with 130 is not good?
No, just 30.
Oh, 30. Oh.
Under 30.
Well, look, he's no Bellow, though. I mean, they're trying to make him out to be the new Saul Bellow. That's ridiculous.
That's an interesting comparison, him and Saul Bellow. I actually buy that. except that in so many ways, he's another, well, he's like, you know, not the head of the Philip K. Dick Society, but 5 o'clock shadow, please, if you get your hand out from it, Robert, I can read it. 5 o'clock shadow, Thursday, today, December 30th, is on,
it's a special.
Okay, well, fine, okay, so you've done it. The point is that everybody has to listen today at 5 o'clock p.m.
Yeah.
On a very special
encore, beginning, end, all in one moment.
Excellent, excellent. Okay. I'm sorry, go on.
Oh, I just was, what's going to be on at 5 o'clock?
5 o'clock shadow with Robert Knight.
That's it? I mean, okay, something special. Okay.
No. It's a special show because all of his shows are special. But he's on Monday through Thursday at 5 p.m.
I listen faithfully to Robert Knight.
When I say there are changes that I really like, that's one of them.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, well, anyway, I think that I don't understand the Leesom thing, but Susanna Clarke, when did you have her?
I'll answer that with a question. When did Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell come out?
Because it was
in December. That I remember, because I remember how freaking cold it was. But it was the December that the novel came out. So I would say it's probably, what, about 7 years ago? Had a guess?
I would think a little bit less than seven.
Maybe.
But maybe seven, yeah. But, no, I loved her footnotes. I've never read a book that I loved the footnotes more than her. And fiction. Footnotes with fiction. And I thought that they were really cool. They were beautiful footnotes.
So, oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, wow. Wow, this is great. So, look, I'm enjoying the show. The Robert, the Gibson story, is that a new story?
No, it's an old one.
Oh, okay.
It's an old one.
Okay.
And I think I'm going to read it shortly.
Okay, well, great. Well, look, I'm enjoying it. Go right on, enjoy the show, and so I'll keep listening, and I'll try to make some of those readings. So.
Oh, that would be great.
Keep on with the great work.
Thank you so much. Take care. Alrighty. Okay, I have to say, I wasn't necessarily actually expecting wonderful phone calls this morning, but they have been. Thank you all. But I am going to read now. No music or anything. It is, 1 second, I have to turn off that TV. Oh, I'm not doing a news show. Anything but. Okay, this story, the following story, is from William Gibson's, was his first professional publication, 1981. Ah, so maybe it's an anniversary. Oh my God, is it 30 years? I guess it is. And yet I remember. Now, you know, Gibson is the person who is best known for his cyberpunk work. He coined the word. You've heard the term cyberpunk? Gibson invented it. Not the genre. The genre existed before him, but he was the one who codified it with books like Neuromancer and the like, Count Zero, and particularly his short stories. I am a huge fan of his short stories like Burning Chrome, New Rose Hotel, that's been made into a movie. Basically, no William Gibson, no Matrix. Okay, there is, and no, it wasn't written by a black woman out in the West Coast. That has been, I wouldn't say, it wasn't proven untrue, but it has never been established and has never been codified. It's basically an urban legend. So anyway, and by the way, a good way to find out about it is look it up on Snopes.com, which is a place that debunks urban legends. Anyway. Bill Gibson's writing has expanded the concept. People adore and love his novels. I like them a lot. I adore and love his short fiction. They say so much and they do so much. And a lot of where he was to go and a lot of where what he was to say was in this short story called The Gernsback Continuum. And this is the first, appropriately, the first book in an anthology edited by Bruce Sterling called Mirror Shades, the Cyberpunk Anthology. This is a book that is still in print and I hope always will be. I've got a whole other rap about that, how there are a few anthologies, collections of short stories by different writers that changed the face of science fiction. They collected what was going on in the genre of speculative fiction at that time. Yes, I use those terms interchangeably. And they put a face on it. Sometimes they move it forward. Other times they take a photograph of it as it exists. And sometimes that photograph propels it into a new era. This was certainly true with Star Science Fiction, which was actually an anthology, 5 books, edited by Fred Pohl. Orbit, edited by Damon Knight, was another landmark series. Dangerous Visions, edited by Harlan Ellison, defined an era in science fiction. There isn't, this is a thick, huge anthology, especially when combined with, again, Dangerous Visions. These two changed the course of American literature, and worldwide literature in many ways, and certainly defined it. Women of Wonder, edited by Pamela Sargent, was another. And then Mirror Shades, The One at Hand, and then after that, Dark Matter, edited by Cherie Renee Thomas. I don't think there's been one since that, to my mind, has, you know, expanded the literature and taken a picture of the field. What Cherie Renee Thomas, what Sterling did with this book, is he took a photograph and said, okay, this is cyberpunk. And he did a brilliant job with it. Mirror Shades, by the way, a lot of people called what became cyberpunk Mirror Shades literature because, you know, you think about the glasses somebody wears in their chrome, right? Their mirror shades. That was an earlier phrase for the same kind of literature before Bruce Sterling excerpted the name cyberpunk from a... from a Bill Gibson story and made that the name of the literature. And Dark Matter, well, we'll have Cherie on the air at some point, but Dark Matter basically defined science fiction and, as she called it, the African diaspora in speculative literature. And boy, was that an eye-opener. And not only to me, but it opened the eyes to, wait a minute, I didn't realize there were that many black people writing SF. And what it also did was it said to a lot of fans, because there was a lot of black science fiction fans, but not that many writers out of Chip Delaney and Octavia Butler and a handful of others, Cherie defined all these other people, found them, and in so doing encouraged so many people to enter the field that had not entered the field before. So now, this many years later, the genre is totally changed thanks to that anthology. So that's my rap about anthologies. This is the one, I don't think there's been one since Cherie's. This is the one that came before. And this one relates to cyberpunk. The story at hand is The Gernsback Continuum, by William Gibson. Mercifully, the whole thing is starting to fade to become an episode. When I do still catch the odd glimpse, it is a peripheral, mere fragments of Mad Dr. Chrome confining themselves to the corner of the eye. There was that flying wing liner over San Francisco last week, but it was almost translucent. And the shark fin roadsters have gotten scarcer, and freeways discreetly avoid unfolding themselves into the gleaming 80-lane monsters I was forced to drive last month my rented Toyota. And I know that none of it will follow me to New York. My vision is narrowing to a single wavelength of probability. I've worked hard for that. Television helped a lot. I suppose it started in London, in that bogus Greek tavern on Battersea Park Road, with lunch on Cohen's corporate tab. Dead steam table food, and took them 30 minutes to find an ice bucket for the Retsina. Cohen works for Barris Watford, that publisher, they publish the big trendy trade paperbacks, illuminated histories of the neon sign, the pinball machine, the wind-up toys of occupied Japan. I'd gone over to shoot a series of shoe ads. California girls with tanned legs and frisky day-glow jogging shoes had capered for me down the escalators of St. John's Wood and across the platforms of Tooting Beck. A lean and hungry young agency had decided that the mystery of London transport will sell waffle-tread nylon runners. They decide, I shoot. and Cohen, whom I knew vaguely from the old days in New York, had invited me to lunch the day before I was due out of Heathrow. He brought along a very fashionably dressed young woman named Dielta Downs, who was virtually chinless and evidently a noted pop art historian. In retrospect, I see her walking in beside Cohen under a floating neon sign that flashes, "This way lies madness," in huge sans-serif capitals. Cohen introduced us and explained that Dialta was the prime mover behind the latest Barris Watford project, an illustrated history of what she called American Streamlined Modern, with an E. Their working title was The Airstream Futuropolis, the Tomorrow That Never Was. There's a British obsession with the more baroque elements of American pop culture, something like the weird cowboys and Indian fetish of the West Germans or the aberrant French hunger for old Jerry Lewis movies. In Dialta Downs, this manifested itself in a mania for a uniquely American form of architecture that most Americans are scarcely aware of. At first, I wasn't sure what she was talking about, but gradually it began to dawn on me. I found myself remembering Sunday morning television in the 50s. Sometimes, they would run eroded newsreels as filler in the local station. You'd sit there with a peanut butter sandwich and a glass of milk, and a static-ridden Hollywood baritone would tell you that there was a flying car in your future. And three Detroit engineers would putter around with a big old Nash with wings, and you'd see it rumbling furiously down some deserted Michigan runway. You never actually saw it took off, but it flew away to Dialta Downs, Never Never Land, true home for a generation of completely uninhibited technophiles. She was talking about those odds and ends of futuristic 30s and 40s architecture you pass daily in American cities without noticing. The movie marquees ribbed to radiate some mysterious energy. The dime stores faced with fluted aluminum. The chrome tube chairs gathering dust in the lobbies of transient hotels. She saw these things as segments of a dream world, abandoned the uncaring present. She wanted me to photograph them for her. The 30s had seen the first generation of American industrial designers. Until the 30s, all pencil sharpeners had looked like pencil sharpeners. Your basic Victorian mechanism, perhaps with a curlicue of decorative trim. After the advent of the designers, some pencil sharpeners looked as though they'd been put together in wind tunnels. For the most part, the change was only skin deep. Under the streamlined chrome shell, you'd find the same Victorian mechanism, which made a certain kind of sense because the most successful American designers had been recruited from the ranks of Broadway theater designers. It was all a stage set, a series of elaborate props for playing at living in the future. Over coffee, Cohen produced a fat manila envelope full of glossies. I saw the winged statues that guard the Hoover Dam, 40-foot concrete hood ornaments leaning steadfastly into an imaginary hurricane. I saw a dozen shots of Frank Lloyd Wright's Johnson's Wax Building juxtaposed with the covers of old Amazing Story pulps by an artist named Frank R. Paul. The employees of Johnson's Wax must have felt as though they were walking into one of Paul's spray paint pulp utopias. Wright's building looked as though it had been designed for people who wore white togas and lucite sandals. I hesitated over one sketch of a particularly grandiose prop-driven airliner, all wing like a fat, symmetrical boomerang with windows in unlikely places. Labeled arrows indicated the locations of the grand ballroom and two squash courts. It was dated 1936. That thing couldn't have flown. I looked at Dialta Downs. Oh, no, no, quite impossible, even those 12 giant props. But they loved the look, don't you see? New York to London in less than 2 days. First-class dining rooms, private cabins, sun decks, dancing to jazz in the evenings. The daughters were populists, you see. They were trying to give the public what it wanted. And what the public wanted was the future. I had been in Burbank for 3 days, trying to suffuse a really dull-looking rocker with charisma, when I got the package from Cohen. It's impossible to photograph what isn't there. It's damned hard to do, and consequently a very marketable talent. Well, I'm not bad at it, I'm not exactly the best either, and this poor guy strained my Nikon's credibility. I got out depressed because I like to do a good job, but not totally depressed, because I did make sure I'd gotten the check for the job, and I decided to restore myself with the sublime artiness of the Barris Watford assignment. Cohen had sent me some books on 30s design, more photos of streamlined buildings, and a list of D'Alta Downs' 50 favorite examples of the style in California. Architectural photography can involve a lot of waiting. The building becomes sort of a kind of sundial while you wait for a shadow to crawl away from a detail you want, or for the mass and balance of the structure to reveal itself in a certain way. While I was waiting, I thought myself into D'Alta Downs' America. When I isolated a few of the factory buildings on the ground glass of the Hasselblad, they came across with a kind of sinister totalitarian dignity, like the stadiums Albert Speer built for Hitler. But the rest of it was relentlessly tacky, ephemeral stuff extruded by the collective American subconscious of the 30s, tending mostly to survive along depressing strips lined with dusty motels, mattress wholesalers, and small used car lots. I went for the gas stations in a big way. During the high point of the Downs Age, they put Ming the Merciless in charge of designing California gas stations. Favoring the architecture of his favorite Mongo, he cruised up and down the coast, erecting ray gun emplacements in white stucco. Lots of them featured superfluous central towers ringed with those strange radiator flanges that were a signature motif of the style and made them look as though they might generate potent bursts of raw technological enthusiasm if you could only find the switch that turned them on. I shot one in San Jose an hour before the bulldozers arrived and drove right through the structural truth of plaster and lathing and cheap concrete. Think of it, D'Alta Downs had said, as a kind of alternate America, a 1980s that never happened, an architecture of broken dreams. And that was my frame of mind as I made the stations of her convoluted socio-architectural cross in my red Toyota. As I gradually tuned into her image of a shadowy America that wasn't, of Coca-Cola plants like beach submarines and fifth-run movie houses like the temples of some lost sect that had worshipped blue mirrors in geometry. And as I moved along these secret ruins, I found myself wondering what the inhabitants of that lost future would think of the world I lived in. The 30s dreamed white marble and slipstream chrome, immortal crystal and burnished bronze. But the rockets and the covers of the Gernsback pulps had fallen on London in the dead of night, screaming. After the war, everyone had a car, no wings for it. And the promised superhighway to drive it down so that the sky itself had darkened and the fumes ate the marble and pitted the miracle crystal. And one day, on the outskirts of Bolinas, when I was setting up to shoot a particularly lavish example of Ming's martial architecture, I penetrated a fine membrane, a membrane of probability. Ever so gently, I went over the edge and looked up to see a 12-engined thing like a bloated boomerang, all wing, thrumming its way east with an elephantine grace, so low that I could count the rivets in its dull silver skin and hear, just maybe, the echo of jazz. I took it to Kine, Merv Kine, freelance journalist with an extensive line in Texas pterodactyls, redneck UFO contactees, Bush League Loch Ness monsters, and the top 10 conspiracy theories in the loonier reaches of the American mass mind. "It's good," said Kine, polishing his yellow Polaroid shooting glasses on the hem of his Hawaiian shirt. "But it's not mental. It tracks the true quill." "But I saw it, Mervin." We were seated poolside in brilliant Arizona sunlight. He was in Tucson waiting for a group of retired Las Vegas civil servants whose leader received messages from them on her microwave oven. I'd driven all night and was feeling it. Oh, of course you did. Of course you saw it. You've seen my stuff. Haven't you grasped my blanket solution to the UFO problem? It's simple. Plain and country simple. People, he settled the glasses carefully on his long hawk nose and fixed me with his best basilisk glare. People see things. People see these things. Nothing's there, but people see them anyway. Because they need to, probably. I mean, you've read Jung. You should know the score. In your case, it's so obvious. You admit you were thinking about this crackpot architecture, having fantasies. Look, I'm sure you've taken your share of drugs, right? Okay, how many people have survived the 60s in California without having had this odd hallucination? All those nights when you discovered that whole armies of Disney technicians had been employed to weave animated holograms of Egyptian hieroglyphs into the fabric of your genes, say, or the times when... It wasn't like that. Yeah, of course not. It wasn't like that at all. It was in a setting of clear reality, right? Yeah. Everything normal, and then there's the monster, the mandala, the neon cigar. In your case, a giant Tom Swift airplane. It happens all the time. You aren't even crazy. You know that, don't you? He fished a beer out of the battered foam cooler beside his deck chair. Last week, I was in Virginia Grayson County. I interviewed a 16-year-old girl who'd been assaulted by a barhead. A what? A bear head. The severed head of a bear. This bar head, see, was floating around in its own little flying saucer. It looked kind of like the hubcaps in Cousin Wayne's vintage caddy. Had red glowing eyes like two cigar stubs and telescoping chrome antennae poking up behind its ears, he burped. It assaulted her? How? You don't want to know. You're obviously impressionable. It was cold, he laughs back into his accent, and metallic. It made electronic noises. Now that is the real thing, the straight goods from the mass unconscious, friend. That little girl is a witch. There's just no place for her to function in the society. She'd seen the devil if she hadn't brought up on the Bionic Man and all those Star Trek reruns. She is clued into the main vein, and she knows that it happened to her. I got out 10 minutes before the heavy UFO guys showed up with the polygraph. I must have looked pained. Because he set his beer down carefully beside the cooler and sat up. Look, if you want a classier expression, I'd say you were a semiotic ghost. All those contactee stories, for instance, are framed in a kind of sci-fi imagery that permeates our culture. I could buy aliens, but not aliens that look like 50s comic art. They're semiotic phantoms, bits of deep cultural imagery that have split off and taken off a life of their own, like, oh, Jules Verne airships and those old Kansas farmers were always seen. But you saw a different kind of ghost, that's all. That plane was part of the mass unconscious once. You picked up on that somehow. The important thing is not to worry about it. Ah, but I did worry about it. Kine combed his thinning blonde hair and went off to see what they had to say over the raider range lately, and I drew the curtains to my room and lay down in air-conditioned darkness to worry about it. I was still worrying about it when I woke up. Kine had left a note in my door. He was flying up north in a chartered plane to check out a cattle mutilation rumor. Muties, he called them, another of his journalistic specialties. I had a meal. Showered, took a crumbling diet pill that had been kicking around in the bottom of my shaving kit for 3 years, and headed back to Los Angeles. The speed limited my vision to the tunnel of the Toyota's headlights. The body could drive, I told myself, while the mind maintained and stayed away from the weird peripheral window dressing of amphetamine and exhaustion. The spectral, luminous vegetation that grows out of the corner of the mind's eye along late-night highways. But the mind has its own ideas, and Kine's opinion of what I was already thinking of as my sighting rattled endlessly through my head in a tight, lopsided orbit. Semiotic ghosts, fragments of the mass dream whirling in the past in the wind of my passage. Somehow this feedback loop aggravated the diet pill, and the speed vegetation along the road began to assume the colors of infrared satellite images, growing shreds blown apart in the Toyota slipstream. I pulled over then, and a half dozen aluminum beer cans winked goodnight as I killed the headlights. I wondered what time it was in London, and tried to imagine Dialta Downs having breakfast in her Hampstead flat, surrounded by streamlined chrome figurines and books on American culture. Desert nights in that country are enormous. The moon is closer. I watched the moon for a long time and decided that Kine was right. The main thing was not to worry. All across the continent, daily, people who were more normal than I ever had been, aspired to be, more normal than I'd ever aspired to be, saw giant birds. Big feet, flying oil refineries, they kept Kine busy and solvent. Why should I be upset by a glimpse of the 1930s pop imagination loose over Bolinas? I decided to go to sleep with nothing worse to worry about than rattlesnakes and cannibal hippies, safe among the friendly roadside garbage of my own familiar continuum. In the morning, I drive down to Nogales and photograph the old brothels, something I had intended to do for years. The diet pill had given up. The light woke me, and then the voices. The light came from somewhere behind me and through shifting shadows inside the car. The voices were calm, indistinct, male and female, engaged in conversation. My neck was stiff and my eyeballs felt gritty in their sockets. My leg had gone to sleep, pressed against the steering wheel. I fumbled for my glasses in the pocket of my work shirt and finally got them on. Then I looked behind me and saw the city. The books on 30s design were in the trunk. One of them contained sketches of an idealized city that drew on metropolis and things to come, but squared everything, soaring up through an architect's perfect clouds to Zeppelin docks and mad neon spires. That city was a scale model of the one that rose behind me. Spire stood on spire in gleaming ziggurat steps that climbed to a golden central temple tower ringed with the crazy radiator flanges of the Mongo gas stations. You could hide the Empire State Building in the smallest of these towers. Roads of crystal soared between the spires, crossed and recrossed by smooth silver shapes like beads of running mercury. The air was thick with ships, giant wing liners, little darting silver things. Sometimes one of the quicksilver shapes from the sky bridges rose gracefully into the air and flew up to join the dance. Mile-long blimps hovering dragonfly things that were gyrocopters. I closed my eyes tight and swung around in the seat. When I opened them, I willed myself to see the mileage meter, the pale road dust on the plastic dashboard, the overflowing ashtray. I closed them. Amphetamine psychosis, I said. I opened my eyes. The dash was still there, the dust, the crushed filter tips. Very carefully, without moving my head, I turned the headlights on and saw them. They were blonde. They were standing beside their car, an aluminum avocado with a central shark fin rudder jutting up from its spine and smooth black tires like a child's toy. He had his arm around her waist and was gesturing toward the city. They were both in white, loose clothing, bare legs, spotless white sun shoes. Neither of them seemed aware of the beams of my headlights. He was saying something wise and strong, and she was nodding, and suddenly I was frightened in an entirely different way. Sanity had ceased to be an issue. I knew somehow that the city behind me was Tucson, a dream Tucson thrown up of the collective yearning of an era, that it was real, entirely real. But the couple in front of me lived in it, and they frightened me. They were the children of Dialta Downs's 80s that wasn't. They were heirs to the dream. They were white, blonde. They probably had blue eyes. They were American. Dialta said that the future had come to America first, but had finally passed it by, but not here in the heart of the dream. Here we'd gone on in a dream logic that knew nothing of pollution, the finite bounds of fossil fuel, of foreign wars it was possible to lose. They were smug, happy, and utterly content with themselves and their world. And in the dream, it was their world. Behind me, the illuminated city, searchlights swept the sky for the sheer joy of it. I imagined them thronging the plazas of white marble, orderly and alert, their bright eyes shining with enthusiasm for their flood-lit avenues and silver cars. It had all the sinister fruitiness of Hitler Youth propaganda. I put the car in gear and drove forward slowly until the bumper was within 3 feet of them. They still hadn't seen me. I rolled the window down and listened to what the man was saying. His words were bright and hollow as the pitch in some chamber of commerce and brochure, and I knew that he believed in them absolutely. "John," I heard the woman say, "we've forgotten to take our food pills." She clicked the two bright wafers from a thing on her belt and passed one to him. I backed onto the highway and headed for Los Angeles, wincing and shaking my head. I phoned Kine from a gas station. A new one, in bad Spanish modern. He was back from his expedition and didn't seem to mind the call. "Yeah, that is a weird one. Did you try to get any pictures? Not that they ever come out, but it adds an interesting frisson to your story, not having the pictures turn out." "But what should I do?" "Oh, well, watch lots of television, especially game shows and soaps. Go to porn movies. Have you ever seen Nazi Love Motel? They've got it on cable here. It's awful. It's just what you need." What was he talking about? "Quit yelling and listen to me. I'm letting you in on a trade secret. Really bad media can exercise your semiotic ghosts. If it keeps the saucer people off my back, it can keep those Art Deco futuroids off yours. Try it. What have you got to lose?" Then he begged off, pleading an early morning date with the elect. "The who?" "Those oldsters from Vegas. You know, the ones with the microwaves?" I considered putting a collect call to London, getting Cohen at Barris Watford and telling him his photographer was checking out for a protracted season in the Twilight Zone. In the end, I let a machine mix me a totally, really impossible cup of black coffee and climb back into the Toyota for the haul to L.A. Los Angeles was a bad idea, and I spent 2 weeks there. It was prime Downs country, too much of the dream there and too many fragments of the dream waiting to ensnare me. I nearly wrecked the car in a stretch of overpass near Disneyland when the road fanned out like an origami trick and left me swerving through a dozen mini lanes of whizzing chrome teardrops with shark fins. Even worse, Hollywood was filled with people who looked too much like the couple I had seen in Arizona. I hired an Italian director who was making ends meet, doing darkroom work and installing patio decks around swimming pools until his ship came in. He made prints of all the negatives I had accumulated on the Downs job. I didn't want to look at the stuff myself. It didn't seem to bother Leonardo, though, and when he was finished, I checked the prints, riffling through them like a deck of cards, and sent them air freight to London. Then I took a taxi to a theater that was showing Nazi Love Motel and kept my eyes shut all the way. Cohen's congratulatory wire was forwarded to me in San Francisco a week later. D'Alta had loved the pictures. He admired the way I'd really gotten into it and looked forward to working with me again. That afternoon, I spotted a flying wing over Castro Street, but there was something tenuous about it, as though it was only half there. I rushed into the nearest newsstand and gathered as much as I could on the petroleum crisis and nuclear energy hazard. I had just decided to buy a plane ticket for New York. "Hell of a world we live in, huh?" The proprietor was a thin black man with bad teeth and an obvious wig. I nodded, fishing in my jeans for change, anxious to find a park bench where I could submerge myself of hard evidence of the human near dystopia we live in. "But it could be worse, huh?" "That's right. Or even worse, it could be perfect," I said. He watched me as I headed down the street with my little bundle of condensed catastrophe. That was The Gernsback Continuum by William Gibson. The edition I was reading from is the anthology Mirror Shades, the cyberpunk anthology edited by Bruce Sterling. And, you know, if I had had a little more time, there are just so many songs that would follow that story so perfectly. It is a great story, a fabulous emergence by one of the world's great writers, albeit science fiction. And certainly, you know, you don't see from that exactly where the whole cyberpunk thing comes from, but it does. It has, you know, it doesn't have the punk at all, as a matter of fact, but it certainly has the cyber. It has the feel. It has the next step to that is the sprawl. The next step to that is burning chrome. Did you notice the word chrome, how often it appears in that writing? And by the way, Gibson has something a lot of science fiction writers of the era lacked. Prose. The man can write. Now, that wasn't always true. In fact, it was almost the antithesis of a lot of science fiction. But not with Gibson. He really got it. I see calls are coming in now, and I've got like 2 minutes before I have to start the outro. I'm going to take one quickly and see if it's about the story. If it is, fine. If not, I have to move on. Hi there, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning, Jim.
Okay, Monroe, it's about the story or nothing at all?
It's about science fiction.
Okay, then it's nothing at all because I asked for the story. Good morning, you're on the air.
Good morning, dear friend.
Good morning, how are you?
And happy birthday.
Thank you so much.
Bobson from Bulgaria calling.
Oh, how are you, Bobson?
Well, I'm trying to get used to the unusual time slot for a show.
Yeah, what time is it there?
Well, it starts at 8:30 a.m. on a Thursday, and it is now approaching 10 a.m.
Wow. So if it's a work day, it's not that bad, right?
Yeah, but if it's not, it's kind of too much light and...
Yeah, I can well understand that. But as you pointed out, and I'm so grateful for you saying that when I had Margot on the last Hour of the Wolf in the Hour of the Wolf, it's always, you know, the Hour of the Wolf somewhere.
Yep. And I've been listening to all the shows you've had so far in the new time slot, and they've been great, except it seems a little rushed. But
it seems very, very rushed. I must say that half hour is a critical half hour. I've always thought the perfect time slot for the kind of thing I do is 3 hours. But, you know, that's not going to happen. I'd settle for
five,
two.
5 would do good, I guess.
Yeah, I did that for a while.
All right. Well, have a great birthday, and thanks for keeping up the great work you've been doing.
And thanks for calling. I really appreciate it. Take care.
You too.
Okay, bye-bye. Yes, phone calls from Bulgaria. I mean, okay, so there is the future there, right? You know, because, you know, he has whatever he's using, Skype or whatever. The fact that he can hear the show through the internet stream and call me on the air here, that's a thrill. That's one that Bill Gibson didn't necessarily foresee in that 30-year-old story. You know, it's funny how new and shiny chromey that story was when I first read it. And in those days when I was doing Hour of the Wolf, it was, oh, yeah, I'm doing science fiction of the 40s and 50s. It was only 30 years earlier, but it wasn't my 30 years. Now I'm reading stories that are 30 years earlier, and I was there. And that's got a really different, bizarre feeling to it, the fact that this is now my 30 years later, and that a story that was new when I read it is scientifically obsolete, even though it's just social. The guy has to go get his film developed. Does anybody remember having to get your film developed? You know, this is, you know, ancient technology. This is so last century.
You open up the camera too soon.
Oh, God. Yeah, I know. You open it up too soon and it's all gone. And then you get the peripheral visions. It's an amazing story, the Gernsback Continuum, about the ultra-white America that was the 1930s and the imperfect world that we have today. And this, and it's true that, the, you know, 1939, the perfect year, the year that was projecting 50 years into the far future of 1989 and all that, and how perfect it was, except for, you know, a few things that he points out. It was all white. It was homogenous. There was no mingling of anything. And as he said, it had all the, whatever the word is he used, but it had all the appeal of the Hitler Youth.
It's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, it really is. And yet that is the perfect dream that so many people that read science fiction and love science fiction were and are yearning for. Except now, hopefully, it's a wee bit more multicultural. And certainly on the future of Hour of the Wolf, we will endeavor to continue to be multicultural. And obviously, Bill Gibson's story of 30 years ago was pleading for it. And we got it. We got it. And let me again say, largely thanks to Cherie Renee Thomas. Before I go off, again, a reminder, this coming Tuesday at the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, 138 Sullivan Street, Ron Hogan presents no less than Rick Moody and Gary Steingart. I will be introducing Ron Hogan, will be hosting. Admission is free. There's no reason for you to not be there. Okay, more information, Ourwolf.com, HOURWOLF.com. You can also write me there, Jim@Ourwolf.com. Thank you all for listening. Tune in again next week, 1:30 to 3 a.m. John Joseph Adams, J.J. Adams, is our guest. And stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clappers. Oh, just stay tuned.
Coming on strong, 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 strong!
People Station! Out of system!
Burn it!
Revolutionary War is a necessary road to real liberation. Could we really win?
Happy birthday to you, Jim Frein. We're celebrating Jim Frein's
birthday until 5 o'clock when Al Jazeera kicks it in. This is Burn Baby Burn, WBAI. WBAI 99.5 FM, New York. WBAI.org.
Why no man frog and a billy could go tell them? nasty chalice in a circle. Wanna bet a bunny till the butchie get purple. Increase fast the chalice in a circle. Wanna bet a bunny till the butchie get purple.
It can't go done.
It can't done.
So I stopped to find out what was going on.
Ideally, you will live on.
Of ya, you know, believe.
Wisdom, knowledge, and understanding. Health and strength coming from the earth.
She was there and sing.
Anyone afraid of death, death no, no life.
As I see and heard them sing.
When you heard them sing. Pass the country on the left hand
pass
side.
Pass the dance sweet like
pass
a swing song.
Pass the country on the left hand side.
It a go fun.
Whoa.
It a go fun. Jano.
Pass the country on the left.
You me no rude boy. Me tell them, pick up, pick up, pick up to all Rasta man who a swing the chalice from hand to hand. You sit down with your colleagues or sit down in a your gang, smoking the herbs and a meditation. Differentiate the right from the wrong. The herb was found on the grave of Solomon. Don't tell them, say we not deal with corruption. We have to show the youth them the right direction. Look for mighty diamond, article Rasta man. Look for Raga Rocks for the teach the nation. Tell them, pass the chalice in a circle.
Exactly 10 minutes after 3 o'clock, this is Lister until 5 o'clock when Al Jazeera comes in. Esther, brand new wake up call. Felipe Luciano, wake up call. 6 o'clock on Friday. Esther, 6 o'clock. Today is your Friday. Thursday is your Friday, your Saturday, and your Sunday. Amy Goodman at 8 o'clock. More politicized than ever. 99 Cinco, Ghost Horse, right after Amy. Yo, this is Ja Rule's favorite tune right here at 99 Cinco List Alive. 24 Wheeler on the case, getting into Booyah City. So wicked we had to name it twice.
Doing 55.
Yo, hear them tune
out.
The good old Sensomania Ganja. Hydroponics.
Start to speed on corner.
Winner smoke, not medical on ya.
Like we are their devil.
List Alive.
Couldn't keep up with me.
cause me too hard. Me too hard. With a 100 with a Cali weed coming from Santa, Santa. 100 with a Cali weed coming from Santa, Santa. Can't afford to get arrested. Arrested, 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 arrested. Lord, I don't have no papers on me, on me. Can't deal with no time, don't a GP.